All right, we might get started. So my name is Vincent. I'll be the chair for today's session. Today we're here to talk about the climate risk management for financial institutions. We've got two speakers here today. That's Stephanie Wong and Saranjit Padam. Stephanie Wong is an actuary in the Suncorp Insurance Capital Modelling team, specialising in general insurance. She has also worked in personal insurance pricing, including risk and demand modelling, optimisation and automated analytics. She is the secretary of the Actuaries Institute Climate Change Working Group. Saranjit Padam is the principal at Deloitte Actuaries and Consultants. He has over 20 years' experience in general insurance and accident compensation. He has acted as appointed actuaries to a number of different insurers and reinsurers and specializes in natural disasters, measuring environmental impact and measuring social outcomes. He is an editor of Actuaries.digital and convinces the Actuaries Institute Climate Change Working Group, and is a member of the UK Institute Climate Change and Working Party. Just a little bit of housekeeping beforehand. So after the presentation is finished, if you have any questions, please walk up to the mic. It is a recorded session. Just state your name and your question. Thank you. All right.
Hi everyone, thanks for coming to this session. I'm going to start and give a bit of an introduction, and Stephanie's going to finish off with more details on some of the ideas we talk about. So I just want to introduce first this is the work of the Climate Change Working Group, which is a working group of the Actuaries Institute. So Stephanie and I are here presenting the work. Stephanie's done a lot of it. I have done a little bit, but not enough to actually get the paper finished. This is the actual paper. It does exist. It has loads of notes in it saying Saranjit to review this, Saranjit to fix this up, which have not been done, so I take responsibility for that. But the paper will come out in the next few days once Saranjit gets to review this and tidy that up. But it is the work of the whole committee, so we do would like to acknowledge people who are not here: Alison Drill, Natalie Warren, Julie Sims, Wayne Kenafake, Avanti Paktiki, and Ignatius Lee. And we've also had reviews from various people, and I'd like to thank them as well, including Elaine Grace, Tim Andrews, and Alyssa Holtz. So this is the part of our ongoing work, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So just to set a context for what we're trying to do as part of the working group, is the Institute has a policy position on climate change, and that has a number of key points to it. The first talking about doing research into the economic implications of climate change, and also to assist in developing government policy to manage risk, and lastly, to talk about measures to reduce greenhouse gases. So part of what we're doing here is collating the information out there. This paper isn't breaking new grounds in science or anything like that, but it is trying to focus on how is climate change exactly going to affect us and our industries, what are the economic and financial impacts of climate change, and also what we can do as actuaries to contribute towards this, and how we can inform the public debate and educate each other on the issues. So this paper we're doing here, we focused in on financial institutions, and we've also when the paper comes out, you'll see it talk a lot about individuals and businesses. We are hoping to carry on and do a next step after this, which will be talking about implications for governments, and particularly their focus on how do we fund natural disaster resilience, and that's slated for the Actuary Summit next year. So we probably won't talk a lot about that aspect in this presentation, but we're happy to answer questions on any or all parts of this. So what is climate change risk? The Bank of England, in their seminal paper at the end of 2015, Mark Carney, the chairman of the Bank of England, came up with a taxonomy of the risks, which I think is very useful, and is one that we've pretty much followed. So he talked about climate risk falling into three parts. The first being physical risks and transition risks and liability risks. Now, physical risks are the direct impacts of increases in temperature, including weather events and how they impact natural disasters. We can talk there about the impacts of floods, storms, cyclones, coastal erosion, bushfires, high temperature events. And essentially, we, from our point of view here, we're interested in what the impact is on insurance liabilities and asset values. Transition risks are the next type of risk, and I guess you can call them more in the investment space. And this is the idea that leads to stranded assets, which you may have heard of. So the idea here is that we're going to transition to a low-carbon economy. In that transition to low-carbon economy, there may be sudden change in asset values due to policy, technology, and assessment of physical risks. So these kinds of changes propose a risk, particularly for investors who are investing in a long-term basis. We'll talk more about those as we go through the presentation. And lastly, the liability risks. This is where the lawyers get involved, either helping people to sue companies for compensation because they've caused climate change, which has caused them damage. And the second part is legal actions against directors and companies for failing to adapt or mitigate against climate change. So we'll talk again about those in more detail. There's been some recent actions on there. So Mark Carney said all these three things pose a risk to financial institutions. And we're trying to break down what those risks are and how institutions can respond to those. So let's do the Trump thing and get that out of the way. So everyone's been talking about Trump, so I feel like I need to. First one is the Paris Agreement world. So the Paris Agreement says that the countries around the world committed to keeping temperatures rises below 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. In order to do that, we can only burn 20% of the carbon assets that we are already aware of. So the oil reserves that have been proved, the coal that's been identified. Out of all of that in the world that's known today, we can only burn 20% of that if we want to stay below 2 degrees temperature rises. And that's only a 50% chance, or 60% chance, sorry, of doing that 66% chance. So this gives a signal to investment markets that says that all those coal or fossil fuel assets that are out there, they may not be worth what you think they're worth because their value may never be realized. They may never be burnt and never provide energy to anyone. And allows the investment market to transition away to a low-carbon economy. So investment markets and people who are interested in that side have what the Paris Agreement has done is given them a clear signal about the way things are going. Now, we know in the world of Trump that Donald Trump has said that he won't be signing or ratifying the agreement, or he'll rip it up or something like that. He thinks that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. So what that means for us from a practical point of view is that the risks don't go away because Donald Trump is saying that. We think it means that there's increased physical risks, there's increased transition risks, particularly if you happen to be in the US or have investments in the US, and increased liability risks. So from the lens that we're looking at, Donald Trump just makes things worse and calls for more action in what we're talking about. So a starting point is to think about climate change and how it's going to impact our economy. I did a presentation about this at the Financial Services Forum, and there's a paper in the UK Actuaries magazine that talks about all of this. So I'm not going to go through this in great detail, but the point that we're trying to point out about this slide is that climate change, through the effects that we've talked about and know about, is going to impact many sectors of the economy. Agriculture is obvious in terms of what we're able to grow and where we're not able to grow anymore. Mining, as we just talked about, coal mining is under threat. Construction and manufacturing, where are we going to be building things and what kinds of things are we going to be building are going to be impacted in big ways. Tourism, if we get to 2 degrees centigrade, as pointed out by Kate McKenzie yesterday, we will no longer have the Great Barrier Reef, which accounts for a massive amount of tourism in Australia. In fact, 2.5% of gross value added. That's what those numbers mean, using recent ABS stats. Energy market's going to change. And because of all those things changing, we'd expect employment trends to change, the kinds of industries people are working in. So in Victoria right now, we've seen the closure of the Hazelwood power plant, and there's a lot of people unemployed now. And that, if that trend continues, we're going to see big changes in employment, particularly the decline of the manufacturing industry in Australia. Housing, where do people live? It's going to change, and health as well. We go on about that in our paper, talking about the potential health impacts of climate change. So just using this very basic analysis, about 48% of economic activity is estimated to be potentially exposed to physical impacts of climate change. There are also secondary impacts. So that's where actually we're much more interested in the financial services sector, because, you know, investments, which every financial institution has, will be investing in these sectors. So particularly in Australia, where most of our economy and particularly the banks are invested in housing and mining and so forth. So investments are affected, but also the insurance areas are affected. We know that, so for example, employment changes are going to lead to changes in workers' compensation. Property is obviously going to be affected. Housing is going to be affected because if you're the bank that lent some money to the houses that were on Kullaroi Beach that are no longer have a backyard, you might sort of be exposed to losses because the insurer is not going to cover it. So maybe the homeowner is not going to carry on paying their home loan on those properties. We've also got impacts on life and health and super and wealth management through the investment angle. And ultimately, it comes down to the household and how householders are affected. I spent way longer on that slide than I expected to, sorry. So this is the important part. The household and how households are going to be affected and how individuals and customers are going to be affected. And Stephanie is going to talk more about that.
Thanks, Ranjit. So how are financial institutions affected by climate risk? And it all begins with the customer. Imagine a story about a typical household and what climate change could mean about its financial position and its household balance sheet. So imagine a worker employed in the coal industry. So say the Hazelwood power station that Taranja has already mentioned is going to be closed. Because of the downturn in the fossil fuel sector of the economy, our worker is going to have difficulty finding a job. So there's employment aspects to this. And at the same time, the family home is located in the Latrobe Valley, so that's where the community has built up around the power plant. And because of the shutdown of the power plant, the property values in that area fall, and there's also contagion impacts from fall in property values in coastal areas, which doesn't help. So the family home falls into negative equity, and the bank is still chasing the family for their home loan repayments. So our co-worker is angry. He goes onto social media. He complains about what he feels is the unfairness of the whole situation, and he does his best to blacken the reputation of the bank. The Asset Owner Disclosures Project has estimated that 55% of our super funds are invested into high-carbon or carbon-intensive assets, and our co-worker is the same. So he's watching in despair as the value of his super falls and the value of his investment assets, his investments in shares, all falls with the carbon transition risk that we talked about earlier. So he's now thinking about joining the class action against his super fund trustees for mismanaging his investments. And at the same time, we've got increases in home insurance premiums, increases in energy prices, and our person is getting no support from his bank or from his super fund or from his insurance company. And that's because these financial institutions in our story, they weren't prepared for climate change. So they're also too busy fighting their own fires to care about their customers. So what kinds of fires are these financial institutions in our story fighting? Well, first of all, they hold their investment assets in the form of managed funds. And they didn't realize that these funds were actually invested into high carbon industries. And that's because they didn't assess their accumulations on a look-through basis. And this is one example of supply chain risk in the context of financial institutions. If they'd only looked at the right information, they would have seen it coming. So it's been said that if you invested into coal investments in the US over the past 5 years, you would have lost 99% of your money. And in Australia, you would have lost 70%. As with all investments, there's a first mover advantage. So the ones who divest of carbon intensive assets first, they'll be able to sell at a higher price. And they'll also be able to take advantage of new opportunities in emerging industries, in renewable energy, and so on. On the liability side, those financial institutions aren't doing so well either. So the general insurers have to deal with the impact of more extreme weather events, and also the southward movement of cyclones into areas which are not built to be cyclone-proof. But general insurers, they're only really exposed to risk for the 12-month policy period. But on the other hand, banks, they write mortgages for periods of 20 to 30 years. So even though we're talking about events that may or may not happen in 20 or 30 years' time, the risk of those future bad debts is already sitting on the balance sheets of the banks today. So the fall in asset values is happening at the same time as the increase in liabilities, and that puts a strain on the capital position, as well as increased regulatory capital requirements to do with the increased credit risk, market risk, natural catastrophe risk. Moody's, the credit rating agency, they've already come out and said that they will take carbon transition risk into account in assessing the credit ratings of companies. So these financial institutions, because they were unprepared, they didn't manage their risks, their profits have become volatile, and they're having trouble meeting their shareholder expectations of steady dividends. So we've talked about the customer, we've talked about the shareholder, but there's another very important reason why directors and trustees can't afford to ignore climate risk, and that is the legal liability issue. Recent legal opinion from the president of the New South Wales Bar has said that climate change risks would be regarded as being foreseeable in the current time by courts, and also that directors who fail to consider the impact of climate change risks now could be found liable for breaching their duty of care and diligence in future. So last year, directors and trustees of the Arch Coal Pension Fund were sued by the members of the super fund because they'd invested in the parent company, Arch Coal, their assets, their shares, in over a period of time when the share price fell by 97%. So they're alleging that there was a breach of duty of care and diligence because the trustees didn't really think about whether investment in that coal company was a prudent investment for their employees' retirement savings. So there were a lot of reasons for the drop in share price of Arch Coal. Some of them were related to climate risks, so they were to do with increased competition from renewable energy or from tighter emissions controls. Some of them had nothing to do with climate risk, like the downturn in the Chinese economy. But the interesting thing and the significant thing about this case is that the words climate change were never actually mentioned in the claim. So this proves that climate change is a financial issue and that it's independent of whether an individual director or a trustee believes in the ethics or the environmental side of climate change. And there are other legal examples, like Farmers Insurance in Illinois. They sued the local government for failing to expand their wastewater drainage system enough to cope with the predicted increase in flooding. So the message is clear. Ignoring climate change could be a breach of the law. So knowing this, how can actuaries assist the boards in meeting their requirements? So as a profession, we've got expertise in long-term financial projections and in informing the boards about these long-term risks, and climate change is one of these long-term risks. We can do cost-benefit analysis to make informed decisions about alternative mitigation and adaptation measures. We can do scenario analysis and stress testing of what a 2-degree temperature increase might look like in terms of our business plans and capital positions. And finally, if we believe that climate change is a material financial issue, then we need to comment on it in the FCR and make recommendations on how that risk can be managed. Which brings me to the familiar actuarial control cycle and the ERM framework as a way of managing these climate risks. So because climate risks are, as Sharandra has already mentioned, they're systemic, they're pervasive, so we need to take a holistic approach. So the framework that we're suggesting begins by looking at the risk appetite statement and the business plan to identify the risks involved. Then we need to go and quantify the risks, including both the probability of occurrence and the impacts if the events do occur. And this is where granular information becomes really important. So for example, geocoding of location detail, exactly what is the construction type of the building, any adaptation measures that an individual building has already undertaken. And this is not just for home insurers, it's also for banks and their mortgage portfolios. So if we take this exposure information and then we combine it with the catastrophe models that general insurers use, then we can overlay assumptions about climate change, future projections from the IPCC reports, and come up with a simulation of the distributions of future losses. And the other thing we need to consider is risks beyond the physical asset exposures. So that's the issue of stranded assets and the economic value that might be lost in those. And other things like political risk and reputation risk will also play a part. So then we can do cost-benefit analysis to prioritize strategies for mitigation, and then design a resilience plan and a risk management strategy for the residual risk. And finally, we need to come back and monitor performance against the plan. So what can financial institutions do for customers? Consider a scenario where a bank has residential mortgage exposure in a coastal location, say Colorado. The bank provides funding for a seawall to protect the town of Colorado. So in this situation, customers win because their houses are protected from rising sea levels and from storm surge. The home insurers win because they're now able to provide insurance at an affordable price. And the bank itself also wins because they are able to protect their mortgage portfolio, and also they get a boost in reputation because they're the ones who made it all happen. So instead of something that looks like this, we could have a win-win-win situation. There are other examples of partnerships that financial institutions have taken that benefit both them and their customers. One example is the Suncorp, and RACQ or something similar, the resilience product, which gives premium discounts of up to 20% for North Queensland customers that have done adaptation measures such as roof strapping that protects them against cyclone damage. And there's also the town of Roma, where the flood risk became so high that Suncorp had to put an embargo on new business. But at the same time, they also worked with the local government to build a flood levy. And once that levy was up and running, Suncorp were able to not only write new business again, but they also gave premium decreases of up to 80% to recognise the decrease in flood risk. On the investment side, we can help our customers by divesting of fossil fuel and of carbon-intensive industries. So one example is the Future Super Fund, which was formed with an investment mandate of not investing in fossil fuel companies or any companies that provide service or finance to fossil fuel projects. And they've done really well. They've made returns of over 12% over the past year. And they've done so well that other super funds like local government super and uni super, they're also thinking of following suit. So what can financial institutions do for shareholders? Directors have a duty of care and diligence to their shareholders. So this means looking after their long-term interests, managing climate risks so that they can protect their long-term profitability. So what does this mean in terms of opportunities? Well, firstly, we can consider climate risk in our investment decisions and what accumulations of risk we might be taking on because of the shares and bonds that we are invested in and the types of companies that we're invested in. There's also opportunities in new financial instruments, for example, green bonds. So they provide finance for projects that have environmental benefits or climate benefits. There are opportunities for innovative new products to meet customers' needs and offset potential climate losses. So one potential example is taking a whole-of-life approach to insuring coastal properties. So properties that we know are going to be inundated by rising sea levels because they're on the coast already. But we can structure an instrument so that the payoff when it does happen can help finance the family's new home so they can move into a safer area. And lastly, reporting and disclosure, I'll go into a little bit more detail. So the FSB, Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, is currently developing a set of voluntary measures for disclosure, including physical transition, liability, climate risks. And the idea is to help the financial markets measure and respond to their risks. What they've recognised is that there is increasing demand from investors and from shareholders seeking to understand their own exposure to climate risk. And there's also demand for standardised disclosure and detailed disclosure so that these players, the shareholders and investors, can understand their own accumulations of risk. These disclosure requirements are going to be market-driven, so there's no government regulation for these disclosures. And that's because there's already enough demand for there not to be a regulation on it. And aside from formal disclosure, the communication strategy of financial institutions is also really important. So that means engaging with key stakeholders, getting them to understand the risks, understanding how they're managing them to decrease the overall risk in the whole system, and also getting the message out there about the good risk management that the financial institutions are doing. So we've talked a lot about what can be done, what needs to be done, but we recognise that there are going to be challenges in the implementation. So in terms of technical challenges, in order to do the type of modelling and quantification that we've said insurers and banks need to do, we need CAP models to be more prospective and also granular enough to capture risk at an individual address level. And they also need to capture things like any adaptation requirements that an individual building has done. And the problem with current models is that they tend to be based on historical data and they're only modelled at a postcode or a CRESTA level, so they're not granular enough. We also need to be able to measure carbon exposure and accumulations on a look-through basis. So this is where consistency in disclosures becomes very important. There are some practical difficulties in translating what does a 2-degree temperature increase look like in terms of financial measures. How do you feed it through your stress test models? And lastly, accumulations of risk on a group-wide basis. So if you write mortgages and you also write home insurance in the same area, have we adequately captured those accumulations and are we modelling them properly? And then once we get over these technical hurdles, there's also the communication challenges. So how do we persuade the board that this is an issue that they need to turn their attention to? And how do we overcome the inertia to make sure that we act quickly enough to manage these risks before they become a major problem? And execution is going to be challenging because financial institutions tend to be conservative. They tend to react rather than be proactive. But we need to, in the case of climate change, we need to move in advance of the risks actually manifesting because by the time they happen, we won't be around anymore. So despite the uncertainties and the challenges, what we do know is that financial institutions who do nothing now, they will erode their enterprise value. The size of the market will shrink as properties, more and more of them, become uninsurable in the absence of adaptation measures. Shareholder returns will become more volatile, and that's because of extreme weather events as well as the asset effect of transition risk. Political risk will become an issue if financial institutions are unprepared for government policy changes in line with the Paris commitments. And lastly, customers who feel abandoned by their financial institutions because they haven't looked after their interests, they will damage their reputation and their brand value. But on the other hand, there is a first mover advantage in financial institutions that adapt quickly. So the ones who divest of carbon-intensive assets first, as I mentioned before, they'll be able to sell at a higher price, and they'll be able to take advantage of other growing markets before everyone else jumps on the bandwagon. And those who manage their risks to protect their long-term profitability will be able to enhance their brand, expand their customer base, and make shareholders happy. So to sum up, climate risk is a material risk for financial institutions, and it's a financial risk. So you don't actually have to care about equity, about ethics, about the environment. Even if financial institutions were driven purely by the profit motive, they still need to be concerned about climate risk, and they still need to do something about managing it. So finally, if you'd like to find out more about these climate risks and what can be done in terms of managing them, I'd encourage you to read the CCWG Climate Change Working Group's paper when it comes out. And if you want to find out more about the Climate Change Working Group, what we're doing now, what we're going to do in future, please have a chat to myself or to Sharanjit about it. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you. That was a very interesting topic. It's actually quite scary. Is there any questions from the crowd? Yes. Would you get a mic? Thank you.
Yeah. Hello. John McEnany from Risk Frontiers. I enjoyed the talk, and I don't have really any issues with your overall thesis, but you had a few gratuitous comments to make about cat models, and which I thought were particularly uninformed. The thing about cat models, or Risk Frontiers anyway, and most others, they will go down to street address level. And if you had the information about that to put into the models, they would certainly take that into account if you wanted to deal with the change in vulnerability. But the main thing about cat models is they're designed to work out the risk in the next 12 months. They're not there to determine what would happen in the case of a climate change scenario. Now, they could do that, but before we could do that, then I would challenge you to come up with the scenario that tells us what would be the increase in the number of hailstorms in different parts of Australia, what would be the change in the distribution of hailstone sizes, and so on for all of the other risks. And then we'd certainly be able to run the models, but you'd also have to tell us what degree of confidence you had in any of those predictions.
Yep, I absolutely agree, John. I think the statement we were trying to make is that you need to be able to do both. So not just have address level geocoding, which I certainly agree your models do. I have no problem with that. But also to be able to superimpose these climate scenarios going forward. And that's not an easy challenge, as you say. I mean, what will be the change in frequency and severity of different natural disasters? Some of the models I'm looking at are built differently. They start on a basis, and you know, a layer within each model includes a climate change scenario, and that scenario is fed in by CSIRO scenarios about future weather conditions based on different temperature changes on the global average level. The way that the damage functions are calculated are based at a much lower level, based in terms of materials, how different materials respond to different stresses and strains and how they respond to different temperatures. And from that point of view, you develop a model based on a climate change model. So these types of models are bottom-up. They are prospective in terms of, yes, they're not looking for the next 12 months. They are looking much longer term, which is what we're trying to do here. And they are sort of different in scope from the existing catastrophe models. It's not a criticism of the existing catastrophe models. It's just saying that we're trying to do something different here, so we need different models.
Are there any other questions from the crowd?
Amanda Aitken from Actuarial Edge. This was a question I had for Kate yesterday and I didn't get the opportunity to ask. I'm going to try it on you instead, if that's okay.
Channel Kate.
Yep. What do you think it will take to convince the Trumps of this world that climate change is a real risk?
Obviously, I've been thinking a lot about this the last few weeks and days. I'm coming around because there's a lot of things where the politics matters. Politics matters in terms of the speed at which we adapt. By the Paris Agreement sets a pace for that adaption. It gives us a time frame in which we do that. Now, the US, if they do pull out, they are they're responsible for, I think, 15% of global greenhouse gas emissions annually. The agreement is still going ahead because the total amount of countries that actually ratified it, even without the US, account for more than 50% of greenhouse gas emissions. And quite frankly, I think that Trump's ambitions to increase the manufacturing base of the US are not going to happen. He can't do it, frankly. So to me, it actually matters what China and India are doing. And I hate to say this to Donald, but I don't think he matters as much as he thinks. The other part to it is that, which is possibly the worst thing I could say to him, to be fair. The other part to it is that the drivers of this transition, politics does have an important role to play in terms of the pace. But I think the end point is inevitable because of the economic and technological realities. So I think Hazel would provide a perfect example, right? There was no government agency or government reason why Hazelwood shut down. It shut down due to economic and technological reasons. It is now getting much cheaper. Sorry, I have to be careful and caveat all this, to do renewable energy. Even the most fanatical climate skeptics I know want to put solar plus battery on their roofs because it's a better product. It's more reliable. It's cheaper. It's a whole bunch of things. It's safer than putting wires in and having a big power station at the other end. So I think if we think about customers and we think about economic realities, the people making decisions on Hazelwood, they're making decisions about assets that are going to be over a 30-year horizon. Whatever Trump does in the next 4 to 8 years, how much weight are you going to put on that if you're building an asset that has to be profitable over 30 years? So I genuinely think that Trump doesn't matter. And, sorry, Donald.
All right, I think that's the second bell, so we're running out of time. So would you all join me in thanking the presenters today?